7:20, back with Rich and Ryan in the morning, and we are now joined by an old friend of KYMN Radio. Welcome back to the airwaves, Commander John Olson. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing quite well. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for coming back. We appreciate that. For those of you who don't know, John used to do a show on KYMN called National Security This Week that people still ask me about. Like, what happened to National Security This Week? But you are just meeting Ryan for the first time. And Ryan thought it might be a good idea to have you sort of introduce yourself and tell us about your background a little bit.
Sure. So I did almost 25 years in the Navy, four at Annapolis, and then almost 21 on commissioned duty as a naval intelligence officer. Mostly Western Pacific kind of stuff for the Navy stuff, but I had tours, a couple different tours that took me to Europe, including my last tour, which was as a naval attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Helsinki before I retired in 2011 and came back home to Minnesota. And since that time, I've been teaching a lot, off and on at Carleton for since 2013. Metropolitan State University at their School of Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice. Did that for a number of years, but I really, really love teaching at Carleton.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. Those kids are so bright. I mean, you have to be totally on for every single class you teach.
Yeah. As I say, one misstep and they'll call you out on it.
They are engaged in the world. They are very hopeful about the future. They're motivated to try and make a difference in this world. And they have very high expectations of the professors, so we really have to deliver when we're in the classroom with them to challenge them, challenge their perspectives, and that's what college is all about.
Right.
And then, as you probably know, I've been writing, co-authoring national security thriller novels with another Naval Academy graduate named David Bruns.
And thank you for defining the genre, because I was struggling earlier today.
No problem. Yeah. And so our 10th novel came out in January, and we just put the finishing touches on our 11th novel. That one will come out in September.
Mm-hmm. I'm really curious, what got you started on the path to becoming an author?
So when I was getting ready to retire out of that naval attaché assignment in Helsinki, you know, you start thinking to yourself, okay, I've done 25 years in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting ready to step into the next phase of my life. What is it that I'm going to do?
Sure.
So you write the bucket list, because you don't know how much time you've got, right?
Yeah,
you suddenly realize, I got all this time. So some of the things on the bucket list were, I would like to teach a college course.
Okay. definitely check that one off.
And I would like to try and get something published, right, as an author. And both those things came through, and frankly, I'm blown away. I feel so incredibly lucky that both of these things have been successful for me, and I find that I thoroughly enjoy doing both things. It's a great creative outlet on the writing side. As you can imagine, as a career intelligence officer, how many reports and things that I had to write that were all totally fact-based and you had to cite your sourcing and everything. When you write a fiction thriller, you know, a national security fiction thriller, I can take 25 years of knowledge and experience, and without giving away any classified information, of course, you can create entirely new stories, and it's all fiction, and you don't have to cite any of your sources.
Yeah.
You just make it up, and we try to do it as close as we can to the reality of what's happening out there in the world.
But, you know, that's what makes great writing, is when you can really speak to all those things, and people who have either been in that career path, and even people who haven't, can be like, wow. Either you can get into the world because it is so specific, or you can say, yep, I lived that life, or I know exactly what they're talking about.
Yeah, and so my co-author, David Bruns, he spent 6 years in submarines when he first graduated from the Naval Academy, and he was an honors English major at the Naval Academy. I was a history major. And he went nuclear power. So that ought to tell you the guy has some gray matter upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a phenomenally gifted writer. So he's really the writing muscle for our team.
Okay.
I do a lot of the plot line, figure out what the story should look like based on real world events. Mm-hmm. I'll do a lot of the really in-depth research. I might do a lot of the chapter outlines, the detailed chapter outlines for battle scenes or how something would work in the intelligence world. you know, how something might play out in the National Security Council meeting, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once we've agreed on all that and done a hyper detailed outline of every chapter in our book, then he gets to writing and he'll do a first draft. I'll do a vicious edit. Mm-hmm. We go back and do a, yeah, you know, a final edit sort of together, and then we send it off for copy editing with our publisher.
Wow. What a great process.
It's a good teamwork kind of a thing, and we've gotten it down where we can sit down on day one, and by the end of 6 months, we've got a completed manuscript.
Incredible. Well, I could go down a whole rabbit hole, but I know we have other things to talk about, but we'll definitely have to have you back in the future to talk more about the books.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
About a week ago, I sent you an email, John. I said, hey, what do you know about tariffs?
Yeah.
And he said, well, you know, you can certainly talk about it, but it's not your area of expertise.
It is definitely not my area of expertise.
So I came back and I said, I'm also really worried about our relationship with our allies in Western Europe. And he said, oh, yeah, I might be able to have a talk about that.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, my time as naval attaché in Helsinki was really an informative period for me. I hadn't really done much with the NATO alliance before that assignment. And being in Finland, which was, you know, like Sweden, not part of NATO when I was there from 2008 to 2011. And we kept trying to convince the Finns, you know, hey, you should seriously think about asking to become part of NATO.
Yeah.
And both the Finns and the Swedish defense attaché, who was assigned in Helsinki at the time, I had many, many conversations, you know, with the Swedish defense attaché. And the statement that the Finns made to me, because I was there when Russia invaded Georgia, right? You remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that, yeah.
At the start of the Olympics in China.
Yep.
And the Finns said to me, look, if NATO had allowed Georgia into NATO, you would be at war with Russia right now.
Right.
And I had to make the point. The reason Russia invaded Georgia was because they're not in NATO.
Right.
Because NATO is purely a defensive treaty, right? Mm-hmm. It's not an offensive operation that we're going to go carry out. It's a defensive alliance where if one member is attacked, all of the other member states come to that nation's defense.
Yes.
You know, Ukraine wants to be a member of NATO.
Mm-hmm.
Ukraine would have to satisfy a litany of requirements before they'd even be eligible to join NATO under the current rule system. So that was one of the reasons why Ukraine was so vulnerable to a Russian attack.
So the current administration has made massive changes in foreign policy.
Yeah.
Almost 180 degrees at times. In fact, there are 180 degree differences. I've been struggling for a week to find a diplomatic way to ask this question. How concerned should we be that our allies in Europe, our NATO allies, are starting to feel abandoned?
Yeah, I think that's probably a spot-on assessment, right? I think the European Union had sort of gone away as a core structure politically, with regards to security policy in Europe, and the NATO alliance, when you were able to bring in Finland and then Sweden. Really dramatically strengthened the hand that NATO had to the point where, I mean, if you think of it this way, I don't know if I'm going to get this framing exactly, but Putin had basically wanted to Finlandize Ukraine.
Right.
And instead they got the NATOization of Finland, which had never happened, right? I mean, the Finns were absolutely insistent upon they will never join NATO, and they would only do it if Sweden did it as well.
Right.
Well, as soon as Russia invaded Ukraine, the people of Finland and Sweden immediately realized what stakes were at hand if they did not become a full-blown member of NATO so that they had a defensive alliance to protect them. So if you think about that construct, the importance of U.S. leadership in NATO, the fact that, you know, we basically pushed for that NATO charter at the end of World War II.
Yes.
I mean, the United States was the leading power at the end of World War II amongst the liberal democratic order. And we created all of these international security and economic mechanisms that have wildly benefited the American people for the last 80 plus years. And all of a sudden, we're abandoning all of those things that we helped create and have made us safer. Now, the U.S. Congress, the U.S. Senate specifically, tried to, I guess, I mean, the word that they used was Trump-proof America's commitment to NATO. But everything is changeable in a democracy, right? I mean, that's one of the reasons why democracy is such an amazing political tool, because you can reform things over time. Within the NATO construct, the thing that has always sort of cracked me up about the way it's been framed under this administration and on the campaign trail, et cetera, was that all these European allies of ours, Canada included, by the way, were free riders on the U.S. Well, after the Cold War, right, once the Soviet Union collapsed and the threat of, you know, a global conflagration with the Soviet Union went away because the Russian Federation simply couldn't keep up with that pace of military development and maintenance and what. I mean, they had huge, huge military, if you, as you might recall, in the Cold War. So as that threat went away, the amount of expenditure that every one of the NATO allies had to make could summarily go down. I don't know if you remember this, but in the Clinton administration, starting in 93 when he was sworn in, the Soviet Union had gone away, and there was the peace dividend.
The peace dividend,
Even the United States of America dramatically reduced our military footprint very rapidly across Europe. Our European allies in NATO did the same thing. We were cutting in the U.S. intelligence community. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those things were happening. And the Bush administration, George W. Bush, when he was elected and sworn in January of 2001, had planned on further cutting the military and the intelligence community. And then after 9/11, things fundamentally changed.
Yes.
And the attacks on 9/11, you know who came to the United States assistance?
Russia.
No.
Ukraine?
Good trade. Good catch. Our NATO allies
sent
combat jets over to fly combat air patrols over the U.S. East Coast while we were recovering from the most catastrophic terrorist attack that has ever happened. So, you know, the NATO allies came to our assistance. That was the first and only time where Article 5 in the NATO Charter had been enacted, and we were the ones who asked for the assistance of our NATO allies.
Yeah.
So the military organizations for all these countries that were NATO members, especially as we expanded out the size of NATO, right, as NATO grew, we asked each of these countries, rather than, you know, committing to, you know, huge ground forces, air forces, naval capabilities, all these other things, we asked the smaller nations if they would simply cover a specific key area of what is needed in combat capability. Can you provide nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare protection? Can you support air defense, you know, et cetera? Mm-hmm. So we actually asked our NATO allies to downsize their spending so that they could focus on lifting all of their people, you know, out of poverty, because everybody has to deal with poverty,
right? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So we were trying to be very, very smart and thoughtful about what we were asking all the NATO alliance members to do to ensure that the NATO alliance stayed strong and could defend against any potential threats out there.
It's just interesting that you bring that up, just only because one of the things that I learned very clearly from listening to National Security this week is poverty or eradicating, but that's national security.
It is.
So, like you're saying, if all these other NATO countries would work on lifting up their people economically, that strengthens the security of NATO.
Yeah, and now, you know, the European Union as an economic bloc, there's about 450 million people that fall under the EU. The NATO alliance is now 32 countries, and the NATO alliance doesn't force any nation to join the alliance, right?
Right.
I mean, they have to apply. All of the member countries have to approve it. And in a free democratic society, you don't want to take away the opportunity for any nation to never join NATO, right? You don't want to take away the sovereignty of any nation's decision-making authority for themselves.
Right.
So we get to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, you know, and things fundamentally change for European security policy.
Yep.
They have to completely retool how they're thinking about national security for their individual countries, for the European Union security policy, and certainly for NATO.
Mm-hmm.
we had sort of a whiplash effect from the first Trump administration to the Biden administration, where, you know, the U.S. recommits itself to the importance of the NATO alliance under Biden. And now we have another whiplash effect where suddenly you have people like Elon Musk talking about the U.S. should withdraw from NATO.
Yeah.
I mean, we would be weaker if that happened as a nation.
Well, sure we would.
So I was a student of history,
mm-hmm.
and I do bring some of these things up in my classes at Carleton. I learned more about this at the Naval War College, but if you really want to understand national security policy and strategy, you go back and you study Thucydides and the Peloponnesian War,
okay.
you know, between Sparta and Athens.
Sure.
And if you look at the construct of what was happening there, Sparta was sort of an independent state. Sure, they had some allies aligned with them, but they were mostly a land power mm-hmm. and a wildly capable military, as mm-hmm. we've seen in depicted in some of yeah. these Hollywood movies, yes. right? I mean, they were a warrior society.
Sure.
Athens was a very powerful maritime nation. Sounds a little bit like the yeah. United States, right?
Yeah.
And they had a lot of different allies that they relied heavily on for the security of their city-state in Athens. And Athens and Sparta start going at it over the Peloponnesian Peninsula. And Athens starts, as because they're the 800-pound gorilla with the big navy, they start extracting a lot of resources and making demands of their allies. They basically alienate all of their allies, treat them right. really poorly,
right.
And to the point where they start leaving the support of Athens and moving towards supporting Sparta, and eventually Sparta captures and conquers Athens.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
you take from cool. that, if you think about that history from so many years ago,
yeah.
Every single conflict that's ever existed on Earth since that time, there are lessons to be taken from Thucydides.
I'm just going to go to the million-dollar question here. Can the President of the United States unilaterally remove the United States from NATO?
So according to the, as I understand it, the law that was passed or the resolution that was passed in the Senate during the Biden administration, it would take something like 60 senators to
okay.
confirm or to extract us out of NATO.
Okay.
Could that happen? I suppose. But right now, with the makeup of the U.S. Senate, that would right. not happen.
Okay.
And that's one of the other things that we've seen happen over, I mean, just since January 20th, right? I'm a big believer in democracy.
Yes.
I'm a big believer in the U.S. Constitution and
yes.
the fact that we have three co-equal branches of government.
Yes, sir.
And the way the system is supposed to work is that Congress, which holds the representation of the people of this nation, right, and the House and the Senate, you have authorization and appropriation of funds to match whatever the president has requested in the presidential budget. Once Congress passes, appropriates and mm-hmm. Authorizes and appropriates funding for positions for people within the executive branch, and it's been signed into law, that's the law. The yeah. president has to execute that law.
Yeah.
Now, I'm a big fan of reform, mm-hmm. constantly reviewing all of the programs that government has, so we coherently reform things when it's not effective or efficient. If they want to make those changes, because the Republicans hold political power right now across the board between Congress and the White House, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But that has to be initiated in Congress, where they say, we're going to authorize and appropriate a different sum of money, and we're going to cut all these, you know, positions within the federal budget. Fine, let's do that.
Mm-hmm.
But the way it's happening right now is unconstitutional. And frankly, I'm deeply concerned about the number of different constitutional crises that seem to be happening all in a very short period of time.
We could pivot and just talk about the headline today about the Department of Education.
Yeah, you should get Steve Poskanzer back in here because he's the lawyer. He can talk constitutional law hours.
We are going to reach out to Steve. We're also going to reach out to your friend Anthony Becker, who is
the
state economist and a professor at St. Olaf.
Yeah, he'd be a really good person to talk to about, you know, the impact of the tariffs. What's interesting, I was just reading before I arrived here this morning, the European Union is planning a whole bunch of counter tariffs against the United yep. States, and they're being very smart about it because they know that rural America has traditionally supported Republicans. President Trump in this election cycle got a lot of support from rural America. So they are going to go after all of the ag states with full force. in their counter tariff approach.
Last time I checked, Minnesota was an ag state.
Yep. Yeah. So all of Minnesota's farmers, people just around here, yeah, and within listening, distance of this station, may very well feel some economic pain in retaliation for the tariffs that are coming on right now.
And that's the last thing these people need right now.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Everybody wants a strong economy.
Yeah, we do, you know. Yeah.
And that is national security.
And that is John Olson right there.
What a
John,
great way to wrap that all up.
I can't thank you enough. I hope you'll come back because I just want to ask you the next time. I just want to look at you and say, Canada, go. And so hopefully you'll come back in the not too distant future.
Well, thanks for the invite.
Thanks.